Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders.
So, I don't know, are you guys fans of the game Clue?
The movie Clue, yes.
I like the movie, too. I think it took place in Vegas.
That sounds correct.
Because, you know, the person got clubbed, spayed. On the spot there. Moni, take us away.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like Moral Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
And welcome back to Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Moni Amin, joined by my effervescent co-host, Dr. Meredith Sherbet.
Nailing it.
And we are live from Las Vegas for SHM Converge, our favorite conference of the year, and joined by two returning guests, two fan favorite guests, Drs. Lenny Feldman and Tony Brew. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them here in a second. But Meredith, before I do that, will you please remind the good people in the audience what it is we do on this show?
Sure, Moni. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews, although tonight, different. We have more than one expert. We have two. And they're here to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge.
Yes. And those two awesome guests are Dr. Lenny Feldman. He is an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at Cash Lack Baltimore, also known as Johns Hopkins. And he is most proud of creating the urban health residency programs at Hopkins and also, relevant to this episode, starting the Things We Do For No Reason brand. And our second guest is the esteemed Dr. Tony Brew, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard and director of the resident education at the VA in Boston. And he is most proud of mentoring dozens of chief residents over more than a decade.
It's been a while.
Great. Well, without further ado, we're going to just jump to getting to know you guys a little better. And in the theme of Las Vegas, will you please share either your most podcast-friendly Vegas memory or something you're looking forward to doing while you're in Vegas that's outside of Converge? We'll start with Lenny.
Sure. I'm happy to go first. My favorite Vegas memory was when I came to Vegas many, many years ago with my dad and my brother. It was for a McKesson convention. My father is a pharmacist, or was a pharmacist when he was alive. And we got to all come as a family to this McKesson convention. And I snuck off and was hanging out in a hot tub in our hotel when this gentleman sat next to me in the hot tub as I'm trying to read a book and starts talking to me. And he says, "You know how to make money? Real estate." And it felt very much like the graduate kind of moment when they say plastics. And then 2008 comes not that far later and real estate goes to crap. So it was a really interesting moment for me here in Las Vegas.
Had you invested after this?
No, I did not listen. I just read my book.
That's incredible. I don't know if you could script that.
No, I'm speechless, to be honest.
What a memory.
Tony, what's yours?
Well, I've been here for bachelor parties, and so I don't really remember the memories from those. But I would say the most family-friendly memory is probably my brother-in-law got married in Vegas. And it was actually the first time I had visited here for any reason other than going to a casino. And I realized, actually, Vegas has a lot to offer other than the Strip. So it is family friendly if you are interested in getting married. There's a lot of places, apparently, to get married in Vegas.
Can you share some of the family friendly options?
I don't recall them, other than the fact that the food was fantastic and the wedding venue itself was also marvelous. But most importantly, not on the Strip.
Did Elvis marry him?
One of the Elvises, not the Elvis.
I imagine the Elvis was no longer with us when
that is correct. Yes. Even before my time. Not Lenny's.
I will I will say I agree. There are lots of things to do off the strip that make Vegas like kind of actually sometimes more interesting, but you have to leave. And from what I hear, you know, around town from my multiple trips here, like twice. But because it's like lots of like cultures and stuff have settled here to kind of help run the casinos and everything. Actually, if you leave the strip, there's a lot of really great restaurants and things outside of the strip. So fun
facts. And real estate.
I'm sure there's good real estate out in the desert.
And speaking of Vegas, Meredith, should we do a Vegas Picks of the Week?
We should.
For each of our episodes?
Yep.
Okay.
Can I go first?
Please.
Well, we just went to the Punk Rock Museum.
I knew she was going to take that one. And it's fitting.
Yeah. It was off the strip. And it's mostly just like going through the different decades of like punk, starting kind of really with like the Ramones and everything, and then going all the way through present day. But in typical like Vegas fashion, it was a little bit weird too.
Very weird.
So you could go and get your tattoo upstairs. They had all the instruments from all of these other bands, and you could go and play the instruments that like they had Joan Jett's guitar. I can't play instruments, as we established before this recording started, when I had to quit playing the clarinet in the sixth grade. So there's that. And with that, I'll stop there. But it was a great find and a lot of fun.
Yes. Unfortunately, neither of us had the appetite for what was a cocktail and a Pringles can. So that didn't happen.
It's a missed opportunity.
Totally missed opportunity.
Yeah. So pick of the week for me for Vegas. You know, the first time I came here was with my friends. And then the second time I came, I got to see David Copperfield, which is like the cheesiest thing ever. But as a kid who grew up watching his specials on TV and remember him disappearing the Statue of Liberty, I was just, me and my brother went, and we were just like the two happiest little kids in our 20-something and 30-something bodies at the time. And highly recommend if you're just into magic and just want to feel like a kid again. I think he's still, yeah, we did see his face all across the MGM Grand when we drove in. So highly recommend.
I remember that David Copperfield special. Like, it was impressive.
Yes. And my family had it on VHS for years. I watched it.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want to record over that. I'm being honest.
And Meredith, I think you're going to take us to Cash Legs before things get any weirder. Okay. So our case, Mr. Raj, he's a 70-year-old gentleman with a history of hypertension, AFib, heart failure, and a reduced ejection fraction, as well as substance use disorder. He uses both cocaine and alcohol. He presents for the treatment of alcohol withdrawal. His initial vital signs are significant for a temp of 98.5, a heart rate of 110, and a blood pressure of 150 over 90. He's tremorous and diaphoretic, has a creatinine of 1.5, which is up from his baseline of 1, and his lactate comes back at 4.7. So, Tony, in my brain, I just assume, because I think we've all said this many a time, that the elevated lactate means that he is not perfusing. But maybe he is. Please educate us.
So this is a topic I'm actually talking about at Converge this year. So I'm happy that you guys are asking me about it. And the way I'm framing the discussion, both for the talk and for the podcast, is that this is a heuristic we use, right? We see an elevated lactate, and the rule of thumb is to say, oh, this patient must have hypoperfusion, tissue hypoxemia. And I want to disabuse the listeners of that idea. And there's a couple different reasons why it's important to sort of change your mindset and your approach. And we'll get to the harms in a moment. But just to start, I want everyone to realize that it isn't so much tissue hypoperfusion or hypoxemia that's leading to the elevated lactate. It's usually something else. And if you guys are interested, we could talk about what those something else's are. But to understand even that, I think it's helpful to look at patients who are clearly hypoxemic and recognize that most of them don't have an elevated lactate. So I'll give you two examples. If I were to put the four of us at the top of Everest, right, I would let us acclimate for a few weeks. But if I put us at the top of Everest and we were on room air, our PO2 would be about 25. And our saturation would be about 50. And I'm taking this from a study that was published in the New England Journal over a decade ago. But our lactate would be basically normal. maybe just a slight over 2, but certainly wouldn't be 4, 6, 10, right? Clearly, we're hypoxemic, but we're not. We don't have a lactic acidosis. So that's one thing I want people to realize, is that the hypoxemia that we see doesn't always lead to an elevated lactate. But then if I was to take a probe and put it into your tissues, you probably don't want me or Lenny doing that, maybe somebody else who like has some expertise, but I would put a probe into your tissues and measure the PO2 in those tissues, right? At baseline, it's hypoxemic. 30s, 20s. And then if I went even further into the mitochondria, it's like 5 or less. So we're always hypoxemic at the tissue level, and particularly at the mitochondrial level, where it really kind of matters the most. That's what's going to shift us into anaerobic respiration and lactate production. So this idea that it's the hypoxemia that's causing an elevation in lactate, that's the first problem. So before I say anything else, just let me pause there and see what questions you have about Everest, probes into tissues, or anything else.
This is like not just true on Everest. This would be true at sea level, and because you're also going further into the tissue level, still going to be hypoxemic.
That's right. And think about at sea level, if you did if you looked at randomized trials of hypoxemic respiratory failure, patients who have hypoxemic respiratory failure, the lactate in those trials on average is less than 2.
Okay.
Okay. So hypoxemia is a problem to be sure, but when we see this lactate, just saying, oh, this must be hypoxia or tissue perfusion, not necessarily.
I'm a little afraid to ask this next question because I'm just seeing like pyruvate and acetyl-CoA coming over.
Yeah, it's coming.
but so if it's not hypoxemia,
yeah.
I guess I don't always equate hypoxemia to lack of perfusion, but then what does cause that?
Right. And it's when we, I mean, I keep saying hypoxemia because really when tissues aren't perfusing, our worry is that they're not getting enough oxygen, right? And so, you know, it could either be that the blood flow is not enough and so the tissues are hypoxemic, or there's just not enough oxygen. So I'm not going to cover a lot of biochemistry, I promise.
Thank you.
But I will mention a few words, right? So most of us have heard glucose goes to pyruvate, and then pyruvate somehow goes to ATP, okay? So the alternative, of course, is that glucose goes to pyruvate, and then pyruvate goes to lactate, right? So the thing I think that I want the listeners to remember, if nothing else, about the alternative mechanism, is that if you have an overproduction of pyruvate, right? So you're going glucose to pyruvate and you're going like gangbusters, you're going to have to shift to an elevation or overproduction of lactate. You can't shuttle it all into acetyl-CoA and ATP production. And far and away, the most common cause of an overproduction of pyruvate is beta-2 activation. And guess what? Every single form of shock is highly associated with elevations in epinephrine, norepinephrine, and lots of beta-2 activation. So I think if you talk to people who've really studied this, they say it's really the beta-2 activation that's causing the elevation in lactate through the production of pyruvate, and not really like, you know, tissue hypoxemia. This point is kind of made because if you guys take care of patients who have sepsis and or septic shock and they're on a beta blocker at home, they have a blunted increase in lactate during the septic shock because they don't have as much of that beta-2 activation. Like, so you can see this even in your practice.
Do you have a question, Lenny?
Well,
I'm not taking questions from Lenny.
I just wanted to see if that relates to asthma and albuterol use.
Yeah, absolutely. So people who take care of patients with asthma have probably seen a lactic acidosis caused by the albuterol and all the beta-2 activation from that medication. So we do it too. If you have a patient in septic shock in the ICU and they get epinephrine IV infusion, their lactate's going to go up, not because their MAP isn't improving, but because they're getting beta-2 activation.
And that beta-2 activation is for all forms of shock or just
hemorrhagic, septic, obstructive, all forms of shock that at least I'm aware of will lead to an increase in epinephrine levels and downstream of that, beta-2 activation, pyruvate production, lactate production.
So then it seems that your lactate is a non-specific biomarker.
That's right. That's right. And it's a non-specific biomarker in sepsis, but even more broadly, it's a non-specific biomarker of just overproduction of lactate. It doesn't it's not a biomarker necessarily of hypoperfusion, which is, I think, again, the heuristic that on rounds you'll hear repeatedly. Lactate's 3, let's give him a liter of fluid. Well, no, let's actually pause before we do that.
This episode is brought to you by Figs. Here at Curbsiders, we're always talking about the latest medical breakthroughs. But if I'm being honest, there was one thing we weren't seeing any medical advancements in: medical scrubs. The ones I used to wear were stiff, itchy, boxy, and definitely did not fit right. Then, 5 years ago, I got my hands on a set of Figs, and I remember thinking, wait, scrubs can actually look good? Figs are made for all of us in healthcare. They're lightweight, breathable, antimicrobial, and oh, they have pockets. For your stethoscope, your pager, that parking ticket you forgot to validate, all of it. I now own 5 pairs, and I don't wear anything else because when I'm in scrubs, I'm in Figs. We've teamed up with Figs, and now Curbsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use the code FIGSRX. We're always talking about advancements in medicine. When it comes to scrubs, you can't get more advanced than Figs. Full disclosure, what I'm about to say is a sponsored promotion for locumstory.com. But the weird thing here is there's nothing they're trying to sell you. Locumstory.com is simply a free, unbiased educational resource about locum tenens. It's not an agency. They simply exist to answer your questions about the how-tos of locums on their website, podcasts, webinars, videos, and they even have a Locums 101 crash course. Locumstory.com is where you should go to find out if locum tenens makes sense for you and your career goals. What makes Locumstory.com unique is that it's more of a peer-to-peer platform with real physicians sharing their experiences and their stories, both the good and the bad, about working locum tenens, hence the name Locum Story. Locumstory.com is a self-service tool, which means you can poke through their content at your own pace with no pressure or obligation. So that's it for this sponsored promotion, which was sponsored by a completely free-to-use sponsor, Locumstory.com.
First of all, I don't think I'd ever put all that together, so thank you. And then talking a little bit about like this idea of, oh, the lactate's high, let's give fluid. So I think this kind of leads naturally into the question of like, what are the potential harms of like decision-making based on lactate?
Right. So they come in a couple different flavors. One is obviously over-treatment with IV fluids. And, you know, Mr. Raj, you know, here at Cashlac, he's got a history of heart failure. So we want to be careful about giving him intravenous fluids if he doesn't actually require them. So that's one. And then I think the other big one is that when we use the heuristic of lactate equals hyperperfusion, it often leads to premature closure and misdiagnoses. And so again, you look back at Mr. Raj, and he's got a number of different possible explanations for his elevated lactate. He's ingested alcohol, which for a different mechanism will lead to an elevated lactate. His alcohol use disorder puts him at risk for thiamine deficiency, which is a known cause of elevations in lactate. And then alcohol withdrawal, as we all know, is highly associated with catecholamine excess. And guess what? That's going to lead to beta 2 activation and increases in lactate. So I think we've all seen patients with alcohol use disorder and alcohol withdrawal with elevations in their lactate level. Oftentimes they're hypertensive, if anything. So it's really hard to invoke tissue hyperperfusion.
I'm sure the cocaine doesn't help either.
No, not. I think the sympathomimetic activity of the cocaine is contributing for sure. I'm not aware of cocaine induced lactic acidosis, but I bet you it exists.
So then when, in what clinical scenario is a lactate helpful?
So I think it's helpful as an initial potential marker of sepsis and septic shock. So I don't think the message should be that we ignore it. I think if you've got a patient who's coming in with infection and an elevation in lactate and their blood pressure is, you know, 110 over 80, I would be nervous that in the not too distant future, they're going to be hypotensive. And so as an early marker of sepsis, I think it has value. The value in tracking it as a marker of resuscitation is, I don't think the evidence is quite there for that.
What maybe besides the lactate, is there anything else that you're leaning on to like help you differentiate these things? Or, because like once you've gotten that initial assessment, then like I feel like you're just kind of going off of a lot of clinical assessment.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any one thing that you can use in isolation, but capillary refill, using POCUS to assess the venous distension or lack of venous distension, increases in BUN, all of these can tell you or give you clues to their volume status and potentially to a state where they need IV fluids. The lactate alone, I would argue, shouldn't be that marker.
I think when I read this article, it to me came home a little bit to, oh yeah, like a good physical exam may take you much further than yeah. all these biomarkers. And I don't know, a little bit of my new age soul died a little bit, but I do know everyone who trained me is like, your physical exam matters.
Does it though? No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, cap refill in these studies is not easy to do. You have to have like a slide to do it. So easier said than done.
So it sounds like, to summarize, lactate helpful for that initial evaluation, not trending lactate so much for like resuscitative aspects, and not hanging your hat solely on a lactate, using it in conjunction with your other physical exam findings and everything else.
Yeah. And I think the for me, the most important take home is when you see that lactate, don't assume it's cerebral or tissue hyperperfusion, but instead generate a differential diagnosis just like we do for everything else.
Tony, are you required at your CashLAC institution to follow up the initial lactate with another lactate?
No, there's no sepsis or otherwise mandate for that.
Yeah, I think that part's that's going to be an interesting one to go out to the world, I think, just with like the surviving sepsis guidelines and all that stuff, which I'm sure we could talk about for a very long time. But in the interest of moving Mr. Raj along his healthcare journey, he improves with supportive care. And
he probably did get some fluids.
He did. We know he did. The initial stages. So when he was admitted, he had both his home beta blocker and his ACE inhibitor were held because there was concern he might become hypotensive with that lactate, as we just talked about. But now that he's improved, in fact, I think this might have happened to me recently. My intern asked about the safety of resuming a beta blocker given his history of cocaine use. I think it's important to start with like the physiology of why people think that makes sense before we talk a little bit more. And then, of course, the hilarious original study from which this all came.
And the why it makes sense is why it might make sense to hold a beta blocker.
Correct.
Right? Okay, yeah. So the idea here is that if you use cocaine, as Lenny alluded to earlier, you get adrenergic activation, beta 1, beta 2, and alpha. And beta 1 leads to increased chronotropy and inotropy. Beta 2 leads to vasodilation. And alpha 1 leads to vasoconstriction. Okay. So I've used cocaine. I have those three effects. Now, if I give a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol, I will get rid of the beta 1 and the beta 2. So more importantly, I will get rid of that beta 2 vasodilation, leaving the quote-unquote unopposed alpha vasoconstriction. And this is the concern. You've got someone who potentially has coronary artery disease, is having cocaine-associated chest pain, which is sometimes vasospastic in nature. And a beta blocker could, in theory, lead to this unopposed alpha, worsening of the coronary vasoconstriction, more ischemia, badness. That's the idea.
And so I remember reading the, like, I read the Things We Do for No Reason article, and then I went back and read the study from which, like, the why we thought this, and just the, like, truly just how did this get through an IRB of it all was, like, they had, I think it was, like, 15 patients inhale cocaine, like, hospital grade, presumably.
Hospital grade. Emphasis on that.
Yes, which is a whole thing that we'll probably mention here in a second. And then injected their coronaries with propranolol, which seems, to my knowledge, not what anybody does.
I don't do that.
Starting with, like, in cocaine use, like, I imagine with the hospital grade stuff is not what is available readily, like, in the community on the street. And then I don't know a lot of people that are directly injecting coronaries when they take a beta blocker. But I just remember thinking that was a very odd study to be citing all of our clinical decision making on.
Yeah. So you know, this is 1990. There's an increasing concern that cocaine use was leading to bad outcomes related to chest pain and vasoconstriction. And there was worry in case reports about the beta blockers. So they did the study, just as you said. And in these 15 patients who got intranasal cocaine, 10 got the propranolol injected into their coronary artery. Again, like, who does that? I know the answer. Nobody does that, at least not that I'm aware of. And they did see in this study that when you have someone use cocaine and then give them intracoronary propranolol, there's more vasoconstriction. Okay. So they published this study, 10 patients, and conclude, like, the second to last sentence of the study is, essentially, do not use beta blockers in patients who have used cocaine. But there's a lot of problems with that. One is, as we've said a few times, like, this was right into the coronary arteries, not the way our patients are using it. Two, it's propranolol, which is non-selective. Most of our patients are not on propranolol. They're either on a beta 1 selective or on something that also has alpha activity. And the other is, it's just 10 patients. I mean, like, tiny. But this has been cited over 350 times. And really, best I understand, it led to this sweeping change, even in guidelines, to the way that we handle cocaine-associated chest pain.
Yeah, it was wild when I realized that that was what we were using to, like, judge all, making all these clinical judgments on. So I guess the more important question is, like, what are the more recent, like, more clinically relevant, like, designs of studies show for this kind of thing?
Well, I'll just offer very briefly one follow-up, which was 2 or 3 years later, that the first author for the first paper, he was a senior author for the second one. In the second one, they gave labetalol through the IV. They're like, you know what? Maybe that whole propranolol into the coronaries, let's redo this with IV labetalol. No difference in coronary vasoconstriction or coronary blood flow, even with, when it was associated with cocaine use. But unfortunately, that didn't lead to, like, a reversal of what had been published earlier. And that's the problem, is that when you get this initial stake in the ground, it's so hard to take the stake out. And just as you were saying, in the subsequent decades, we've seen a number of cohort studies. We have some prospective, mostly retrospective, demonstrating that there are no increases in MI or mortality for patients who have used cocaine and who are on a beta blocker or who get a beta blocker afterwards, like in the post hospitalization period. So I really think this is one where we are subject to a fascinating study, interesting study, but a flawed study. But because it came first and because they were so definitive in their conclusion, which is what a lot of people read, it's been very, very hard to reverse that trend. I still hear it mentioned quite often that we should avoid beta blockers. And particularly the more selective beta blockers like metoprolol or the ones that have alpha activity like labetalol, I think the data is pretty clear in these larger cohorts that it's safe.
So a very brief summary for this, which is we should probably be using them in beta blockers in patients who have cocaine use history. Like, it's,
if they have another indication.
If they have an indication.
Right. That's right.
At the very least, if they have another indication, we should most likely be giving them.
That's right. Because I think the idea there is that the benefits for that other indication, whether it's CAD or heart failure, outweigh the potential downsides of giving it in not an intracoronary form, but in an oral form.
And the numbers needed to treat, particularly for a reduced EF, are so low with beta blockers that it's just hard to imagine you're going to get anywhere close to a number needed to harm when the patient is also using cocaine.
It kind of almost the way people write those articles, though, because of that first article, it still seems like people are a little timid to take a little bit stronger of a stand. Like, and when I remember reading them and just thinking, like, it seems like they've got much better data than that first study, and no one's willing to have the same, like, you know, stake. Which, like, probably for the best, but, like, just seems interesting to me that we have had multiple studies at this point that have shown that.
Right. And not just experimental studies, but like studies with true outcomes, like MI, mortality, not just did the coronary artery constrict a little bit more. Interesting, but I don't think the patient cares a whole heck of a lot.
And it's interesting in the sense that people were so scared to use beta blockers in heart failure patients for so long, yet we got over that, right? There was enough data, we got over that. And yet we can't seem to get over this. Even with the data that's out there, it's hard to imagine.
What I struggle with is that why I don't understand why it's so hard to get over, too, is the cocaine supply is not hospital grade cocaine supply that our patients are using. So the like reality of the situation is much murkier than what any study is really like able to reproduce. And so I agree, like the number needed to treat for the known problems, like maybe Hanger had a little bit more on that than kind of the areas that have too much kind of murkiness for you to make a good clinical decision. So I think that's a good maybe segue into the next topics. So Mr. Raj is just having a hospital course. So in talking with the family a little bit more, the team learns that the patient has actually been having falls monthly at home. And it's actually prompted a couple of other ER visits for minor injuries. No head traumas have ever been reported by the family. And the tentative plan right now is for him to return back to the same living environment that he was in. So the intern is concerned, rightfully so, about all of these falls and would like to stop his anticoagulation that he was on for his known AFib on discharge due to the frequency and severity of the falls reported by the family. So this kind of takes us to the next topic. Do the patients who are like at high risk of falling have, let's start with increased risk for intracranial hemorrhage, because that will kind of lead us into everything else.
Sure. Well, what I can tell you, and I don't think you'll be surprised by this, is that someone who has a history of falls is more likely to fall again than someone who does not. Someone who breaks bones is more likely to break bones again than someone who did not break bones before. Whether that fall will be hard enough to lead to bleeding in the brain is a much harder question to answer. And the data is not very clear. Clearly, every time you fall, you don't bleed into your brain, whether you are on anticoagulation or not on anticoagulation. And many of the original studies for evaluating warfarin or evaluating warfarin versus DOACs, they didn't often include people who had histories of falls. So now we have to do a lot of observational studies because you're also not going to do a randomized controlled trial on this. So they're observational studies. So there are some observational studies. There's a study that looked at Medicare patients, about 1,200 Medicare patients, who were listed in their chart when they were hospitalized as having a high fall risk. They had atrial fibrillation. They were discharged. Some of them, about a third of them, on anticoagulation. They compared them with 18,000 patients who did not have high fall risk listed in their chart. About 50% of them were on anticoagulation. That was warfarin in the study for both of the groups. And the group that had a history of falls did indeed end up falling more, fracturing more, and had more intracranial hemorrhage than the group who had never fallen. But if you look at the hazard ratio of the composite endpoint that they were looking at, which was hospitalizations for stroke, stroke, death out of the hospital, and hemorrhage, the hazard ratio was still below one for the patients who were receiving anticoagulation and had histories of fall. So, yes, you probably do have an increased risk, although there are other studies that have been done that didn't show that increased risk. But often these studies are very small numbers of patients who have fallen who are on anticoagulation. People are pretty reticent. But those studies have not clearly shown that you always have an increased risk of intracranial hemorrhage. And of course, you have to weigh that harm versus the benefit of stroke prophylaxis. And so at some point, yes, there will be patients who their risk of falls, because they maybe have bled into their brain before, is so clearly obvious that, okay, there's probably contraindication to putting them back on anticoagulation. But for the most part, patients' risks, if they have a significant risk of having an ischemic stroke, outweighs that risk of having that intracranial hemorrhage and often leads us to not hold the anticoagulation.
And so this is talking about this solely for like intracranial hemorrhage versus stroke risk as your like cross comparison, correct?
Well, certainly you could look at other outcomes, bleeding. Although I think most of us have seen patients on anticoagulation bleed. I think very few of us, because maybe I'm not in the ICU, but very few of us actually see them die from bleeding. But I think all of us have seen patients with really bad outcomes from ischemic strokes because they weren't on their stroke prophylaxis treatment. Or even if they were on stroke prophylaxis and still had a stroke, it's still possible. Plenty of patients have that happen to them. It's not a perfect drug. Yeah, you can look at bleeding, other forms of bleeding. You can look at intracranial hemorrhage, and then you can look at the benefits, which typically are stroke, prophylaxis, and systemic emboli.
And then walk me through a little bit about, how do you think about it with radio? Like, I always get stuck because I'm like, their CHADS VASC is like 200, and their HAS blood is like 3,000, and I don't know what to do with those numbers. They're both super high. They're high risk for ischemic stroke, high risk for bleeding. And like guidelines are kind of like, just go and talk to the patient. But the patient's kind of like, well, you're the doctor. What do you recommend? And I don't know that all of those like scoring systems and everything communicate well across each other. And so I'm just curious how you think through that.
Well, one of the problems with the bleeding scores in particular are that many of the variables that they use to calculate the bleeding score are also the same variables that increase your ischemic stroke score. And so it is your patients often who are at highest risk of stroke who are also at highest risk of bleed because they use many of the same variables. So I don't think you should ever use the bleeding score in isolation to make a decision about whether to anticoagulate. And probably what we should use those bleeding scores for is to make us think, wow, this patient's bleeding score is high. Do I have any opportunities to mitigate that? Can I do something to decrease their risk of bleeding? So, for instance, maybe our patient should actually be started on medications to help with his alcohol use disorder. And maybe we should be trying to get him to rehab. And if we know that his risk of bleeding, and there are a couple of, there's like five different bleeding scores now that are out there. Two of them actually include alcohol use disorder as a variable. So maybe when I see his bleeding score is high, I go, oh, I should really be trying to treat his alcohol use disorder. Hopefully we don't need that to trigger it, but sometimes we need things to help trigger us. Or maybe I should be looking at his other medications that he's on to see if there's anything that can be contributing. Oh, that benzo, maybe he shouldn't be on that benzo. And is there a way to help mitigate by getting rid of some of his medications? Or can we have a really good discussion with his family about where he's going to go home to get him to rehab first? And maybe we can make sure that there is someone who's going to be able to provide more oversight of him at home. And so I think it hopefully gets us to have those conversations about mitigation, but not for us to say, oh, bleeding score high, no anticoagulation for you, despite however high your ischemic stroke score might be. What I think is interesting about some of the new stroke scores that are out there, the Garfield AF, the, I assume it's pronounced Atria score, sometimes, and even in our patient, if you actually run our patient through, and we actually would needed to have a few more details to run him through some of those scores, the Garfield AF and Atria actually had him at lower risk than his CHADS VASC. And they actually put him in a low-risk category for ischemic stroke. So I think that's really important for us to think about what is the actual risk of ischemic stroke, because we don't want to put everybody on anticoagulation if their risk of stroke isn't high enough. His CHADS VASC puts him at about a 3, which is about 3% per year risk. All of the guidelines say give anticoagulation for anybody who has a risk greater than or equal to 2%. So based on CHADS VASC, which is what most of us use, which is the most well-validated, you would go with that. But if you look at Garfield AF and if you look at Atria and you go, this patient's actually at lower risk than I thought based on those, and he's falling all the time, well, maybe that changes your calculus. So I don't think it's a bad idea to try some of these other risk scores out, although they aren't generally as well validated as CHADS VASC.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel like you can never get ahead on your charting? Well, imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. And I am one of them. I've been using this for over a year. It is revolutionary, it is game-changing, and you need to try this technology. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Visit freed.ai and use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's freed.ai and use the code CURB50. This episode is brought to you by Continuing Education Company. Are you a primary care clinician or hospitalist looking for high-quality, unbiased CME? For over 35 years, Continuing Education Company has been a trusted leader in accredited medical education. All of their courses are ACCME or AAFP accredited, offer ABIM mock points, and are completely free of industry support, ensuring independent, evidence-based learning. Attend a live conference at stunning destinations like Hawaii, Alaska, or Florida with half-day sessions. You'll enjoy expert-led education in the morning and free afternoons to relax or explore. Every in-person attendee also receives a free 15-credit online course and free 30-day access to conference recordings. Prefer to learn from home? Continuing Education Company has you covered with live webcasts and over 600 hours of on-demand courses covering topics like women's health, internal medicine, and hospital medicine. Missed a live event? Their on-demand replays let you experience past conferences at your own pace. And a special offer for Curbsiders listeners, save 30% off on all online courses and live webcasts with promo code CURB30. Visit www.cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to explore all offerings and claim your discount. Whether live, online, or on demand, Continuing Education Company makes earning CME easy and rewarding. Continuing Education Company, educating clinicians, enhancing patient care.
What about for the people who are high risk and let's say learner on the team is just really worried about it and they're like, well, what if we compromise and like dose reduce him?
So I love that. I love compromises. I think what you will see is if you dose reduce him for particularly, say, let's say apixaban, you are not going to get the benefit of stroke prophylaxis that you want. And so there are, and we have a things we do for no reason on this, there are patients who are appropriate for dose reduction. Falls is not one of those reasons. It is based on age, it is based on weight, it is based on creatinine that the FDA has approved. If you're greater than 80, if your weight is less than 60 kilograms, if your creatinine is greater than 1.5, if you have two out of three of those, you dose reduce based on that, not because you're worried about the patient's risk of falling.
Not based on feelings.
Not based on feelings.
And what about, let's say, I think one of the things the pharmacist catches me on a lot is, so have like identified that for him, frequent falls, but hasn't, like for Mr. Raj, who's had the falls, but no like brain bleed before, and could have the conversation with his CHADS fast versus like his Garfield AF. But let's say we make the decision that we want to anticoagulate him. Let's say he's on aspirin though for, I don't remember if he had CAD, but let's say he had CAD too. So the pharmacist often will say, do you still want to continue the aspirin while on the anticoagulation? And is there any like kind of guidance for thinking through that?
So I'm going to go in two different directions. One question that I think is people often will think about is, well, if he's on aspirin, does he really need anticoagulation? And the answer there is aspirin is not a reasonable thing to introduce in order to not be on anticoagulation. It does not decrease your risk of ischemic stroke and nearly as much as your anticoagulation, and generally gives you many of the same risks for bleeds. So I would not replace your anticoagulation with aspirin. The second direction I would take us in is that in general, I think we often forget that anticoagulation warfarin was sort of the first aspirin. It was the medication that we were using to help prevent heart attacks. And then we found aspirin. And aspirin helped to prevent heart attacks and tend to do that with a little bit less bleeding than your anticoagulation. So being on a DOAC is a good medication or warfarin to help decrease your risk of having a heart attack that you don't also need to add aspirin onto. So having them both on at the same time, in general, I would try to avoid. There are going to be some circumstances where you do it. Particularly if they have relatively fresh stents, things like that. But as much as you can avoid having people on aspirin and your anticoagulation at the same time, I think you're doing your patient some good.
I'll just add to that, that's guideline supported. So in patients who have atrial fibrillation and stable CAD, and stable is defined as PCI, MI, or CABG more than a year ago. Right. So if you've got those two things, DOAC monotherapy is recommended by nearly all cardiology societies, again, after that first year. So we should be looking for opportunities to tear away that aspirin and use DOAC monotherapy. Because fortunately, over the last 5-6 years, we've had two large randomized trials that support monotherapy. And again, guidelines support that.
And then triple therapy, even worse.
Please, yeah. That was the things we do for no reason, too.
Okay. So you already mentioned, so like really what's going to benefit Mr. Raj is thinking about ways to reduce the fall risk, giving him the anticoagulant for what he warrants, and moving on with life and not making the decision solely on fear and feelings of falls. Because that's the conversation that happens. I feel like he's going to fall. It's not always based on fact.
Well, I think it's very similar, as you alluded to earlier, to our last discussion, where when we give something, we feel like that can cause problems. And if we're not giving it, then things are okay. And so, right, we give the beta blocker, and if the patient's using cocaine, oh no, we're causing a problem. If we give the anticoagulation and he falls and hits his head, oh my gosh, that's all our fault. But if we don't give him the beta blocker and his heart failure gets worse, okay, well, that wasn't our fault because we didn't give anything. Or if we don't give the anticoagulation and he strokes out, well, okay, that's not our fault because we didn't do anything there, right? I think there is often the active sort of doing it something that makes us scared. But we need to remember that when we're not doing something, we're actually also doing something.
Yeah. I agree.
They have done these Markov decision analyses that are pretty neat. Two of them done, one in 2021 and one in 1999, where they were trying through their analysis to decide how many times can you fall before the risk becomes too great that you should not be on your anticoagulation. So the most recent Markov analysis says that if you are using warfarin over no anticoagulation, you need to fall 35 times before the risk of falls becomes too high. If you are using apixaban versus aspirin, you would have to fall 458 times. And they couldn't even calculate it for apixaban versus no anticoagulation. It was sort of infinite. So it's at least 458 times that you need to fall before there is more risk of being on apixaban than not. I think those are pretty stirring numbers. Now, these are Markov decision analyses. It all depends on sort of the data that you put into it and how good the data is, then really makes a difference on what the results are. But I think the data that they put in seemed fair and is probably true. You can fall many, many, many times before your risks become too high. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, so two
one
more
thing. Last thing. What's very clear is that DOACs are better than warfarin. Very, very clear. So I would not put our patient on warfarin. The bleeding risk is much higher with warfarin, and particularly with apixaban, your bleeding risk for intracranial hemorrhage, your overall bleeding risk, your GI bleeding risk is lower than with warfarin. That's not necessarily true with some of the other DOACs, where the GI bleeding risk is higher than warfarin, but apixaban, it is lower.
And I guess on that topic, then correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Hasblood 2 off of warfarin studies?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so the newest of all of these bleeding studies is DOAC. And that's been out since 2023. So it's still going through its paces. But that one actually looks at DOACs.
Those were excellent points to add. Appreciate. We'll just kind of wrap up our case with Mr. Raj, who's had a stirring hospital stay.
Stirring, truly.
And we're getting ready to discharge him.
Big
We've
day.
Had all these conversations with the family. Med rec is done, and it's 12:01.
I don't like where you're going with this.
And family can't get there till 4 p.m. today. You've received 3 emails about priority discharges while you're on rounds with your team trying to teach about anticoagulants and pyruvate. And, you know, this really begs the question, should you hold on to Mr. Raj until tomorrow morning so that he can be discharged before noon?
Should we do a poll? Poll the room.
The question I want to know is, what's the latest any of you have ever discharged a patient?
Nine 31 p.m.
Not a self-directed discharge, of course. So 9:31
p.m.
Okay.
Oh, I've definitely had patients go home around midnight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't remember, but yeah, somewhere between 9 and midnight.
Yeah, I mean, I've discharged them earlier in the day, and then they didn't leave till like 1 or 2. And then I actually asked our person who's in charge of this, did that count for my discharge before noon for the next day? It does not.
That's like the gremlin rule.
Yeah.
Like, you know, no eating after midnight, but when does midnight end? Like,
yeah.
7 a.m. is now breakfast time?
It's really an existential question we're having here.
Clearly, this is pandering to our hospital medicine colleagues, but really, what do we think about discharge before noon? I know we get paged and emailed and texted, all the things, but data and or just feelings. Facts and feelings. Frank, Lenny, please.
Yeah. Discharge before noon is such an interesting concept. I think what the first thing that we have to think about is why. Why are we trying to discharge before noon? What problem are we trying to solve? And if we know what problem we're trying to solve, then we should probably be following those metrics to make sure that we are solving them. And if we are trying to solve those things, we should probably also look at balancing metrics to make sure other things aren't getting out of whack because we are trying to get this patient out before noon. So I think in general, we are hoping that if we discharge someone before noon, that is going to help the emergency department. And in particular, that is going to help the emergency department not have as many boarders and not have the boarders stay as long in the emergency department. And it is quite clear that the longer someone stays in the emergency department as a boarder, that's a bad thing. And we also know in many institutions, including Cashlack Baltimore, that if someone stays in the emergency department, their care doesn't always necessarily progress forward while they're there in the emergency department at the same rate it would have had they been on the internal medicine floor or the pediatrics floor. So that's one of the metrics. Oftentimes, people also think about, well, will it decrease length of stay? If we get patients into a bed earlier, we'll progress their care faster. We'll get them out of the hospital faster. So maybe we will decrease length of stay. And then maybe we bring in patient satisfaction into all of this, that the patient will be happy to be able to get out of, early. They can get back to their lives. All is good. I think one of the things, and you know, we could have talk about this for a while, is like when you have a patient that you discharge before noon, why the heck is that person there? Like, what is it that made you have that person there that could be discharged before noon? Why didn't they go home the night before? So my child was just hospitalized with orbital cellulitis, needed to have antibiotics, and we set out a certain length of antibiotics, and the antibiotics ended on 6 a.m. And so for us, antibiotics were done. This was an easy decision to get him out before noon because there was absolutely no reason for him to be in a hospital after he got his final IV antibiotics. Now, you could argue, was that final IV antibiotic that he got at 6 a.m. even useful? I don't know. He had group A strep. He probably could have been on amoxicillin the night before and gone home. We didn't fight it. But right, you could have those conversations about should he actually stay that long. For many of our patients, I don't know, we think about maybe they need labs in the morning. Well, for many of us, it is hard to get those labs in the morning, and particularly in a time period that is going to allow you to get the patient out before noon, because apparently you're going to make decisions on those labs, which is why you got them. So you're having to get them and then wait for them to come back and then look at them. And what are you doing in the meantime? So there's those patients. But really, what are some of the other categories of patients who are sitting there that you couldn't have sent them home the night before? And so the balancing metric that I think oftentimes we don't always look at is length of stay in this. And there have been a number of studies now that have looked at discharge before noon. Now, one of the big problems of all of these studies, you can't do a meta-analysis of these studies. You can't. And why can't you do a meta-analysis? It's because all of them are different, right? Every institution that comes up with a discharge before noon plan, everybody has a different plan for how that's going to work. And some of them are really intricate and involve lots of different folks and hiring more people and getting the social workers and case managers, and everyone's having huddles the night before and using a computer to follow them all, right? And then there are studies where all they did was tell the doctor to try to make sure that they got the patient out before noon, right? So very, very different methods for trying to get discharge before noon, which makes a systematic review and meta-analysis really impossible. And there are some studies where patients have gotten out earlier and length of stay has gone down. New York University has had two studies in the Journal of Hospital Medicine where they were able to get patients onto the floor at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m. because they were discharging more patients before noon. That was really the big benefit for them, was to get patients on average to the floor at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m. That was statistically significant. They spent a whole lot of effort to get patients out before noon. We can then argue about, is there any clinical utility to getting a patient onto the floor at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m.?
Well, if my shift ends at 5, there's some tremendous clinical significance to that. Right, because I won't have to admit them anymore.
For sure. So it is, and then there are studies where at UCSF, the length of stay went up. At Stony Brook, the length of stay went up. So there are some real questions about whether discharge before noon actually gets us to the outcomes that we actually want, even if you can get the patient discharged before noon. And then we all know that discharging patients before noon drives all of us crazy, and particularly in academic centers where it has not been the routine and gets us out of our routine. And is it worth driving all of us crazy for outcomes that we don't know actually are meaningful or are leading to good?
And as we established off air, it always comes back to me. And this is really about our satisfaction. So
is that a counterbalancing metric in any of these studies, crazy providers?
What has been a counterbalancing measurement is resident satisfaction. They did that in the Stony Brook one, and it was so interesting because the way that the Stony Brook has their conclusion was they thought their study was very positive, that things were improved. Their length of stay went up by 1.47 days. 1.47 days by doing discharge before noon. And 55% of the residents who completed their survey said that it affected their education negatively. So it is really hard for me to believe that, yes, they were able to discharge patients before noon, but that actually resulted in good. But one of the problems in medicine is the incentives, especially if you have geography. We have all of our teams have geography, which means every patient I discharge, that means that bed is going to get filled up. And so if I have discharge before noon as an incentive, and I'm thinking about the patient at 5 o'clock going, do we want to put in the extra effort to get him home tonight? I could get him home tonight, but I could also leave him here so that we could discharge him before noon. I don't have to have a new patient in that bed that I have to think about. And I get to be able to say he was discharged before noon. How perverse is that? And I think that's why you saw the length of stay go up in Stony Brook and UCSF, because of that perverse incentive structure.
Well, if you have pay for performance metrics where providers are incentivized, then that really becomes problematic. Do you guys have like morning resident conferences at your versions of CashLAC?
Not consistently. I think they do it once a week. They have upper level conference, but not for the interns. And then we have recently instituted a new interdisciplinary team rounds with everyone at 9 a.m. coupled with the push for discharge before noon. So now it's very incentivized for like a mad rush. So I don't know how you measure making all of us crazy, but someone can come up with that because there's that mad rush in the morning. And then by the end of the day, like truthfully, it's very difficult to then wrap your head around everything that just happened in the morning to like move anything forward. And there's nothing that happens in the afternoon either to incentivize the morning rush the next day.
Yeah, Cashlack Boston, or one of, there's many of them that I work at. And one of them has slowly moved their morning report earlier and earlier. 8, 7:30, 7. There's even rumblings of moving it before 7 a.m. Like that's like surgeon time. All for the idea of if we have the residents have their conferences end earlier, they'll round earlier, they'll discharge earlier. It does not work, or it has not worked, I should say, at Cashlack Boston.
And then the other part of it that we haven't mentioned yet is if you are spending time discharging somebody before noon, it means you're not spending time doing something else, which may mean education, but it also may mean the sick person who it's better for you to see in the morning than it is in the afternoon, whose care you needed to progress, whose care didn't progress because you were making sure that you were discharging the person you could have discharged the night before. I just think we need, first of all, to think about if length of stay is really the big issue, is this the best way to get it length of stay? Are there other ways of getting at length of stay? And I think all of us would say, oh, that we have plenty of ways of getting a length of stay. We have all these patients who need to go to rehab and blah, 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 blah. That, it, you know, focusing on discharge before noon may not be the best thing to focus.
Yeah, I think it just becomes an existential conversation about what is time, because we're sort of just moving the day hospice position to be actually a night position to get everything ready for like noontime. And then the nocturnist would be doing like, you know, day position.
And speaking of time, we have taken a lot of your time this evening. And it's been such a great discussion. I feel like I could talk to you guys about all of these topics for just literally, we could do a single episode, I think, on each of these topics. But in the interest of everyone's time, I think we have had a great discussion, great like ranting as well, I think, because these are all things that we all have been in, you know, teaching sessions or just rounding with our teams talking about. So just brief take home points before we close out for our topics.
So, all right. So one for each. So for lactate does not mean hypoperfusion. It means beta 2 activation. It means other things too, but just start with that. And then for cocaine associated chest pain, do not fear the beta blocker.
For our patients with atrial fibrillation, calculate what you think their risk of their ischemic stroke is. Calculate what you think their bleeding risk is, but use that to try to mitigate their risk of falls and their risk of bleeds. For discharge before noon.
Yeah, Lenny, what do you got?
Let's rest.
I would say it is not the metric we should all be following unless we get better data. I think it is very possible that you can do really good PDSA cycles at your institution to figure out ways of getting, of decreasing length of stay, but everybody falling in line with discharge before noon, probably not the answer.
So this has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more?
Yep.
Join our Patreon and get all episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox, including our Curbsiders Digest, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And here at The Curbsiders, we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And a special thanks to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at PodPaste. Bless you for having to edit this video from Las Vegas. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Waddle runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed the theme music. And with all that, I've been Moni Amin.
And I am still Meredith Trubit. Thank you and good night.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
July 4th member-only doorbuster deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, rewards members save $50 on a select Charbroil 4-burner gas grill, now just $149. Plus, save over $500 on a Whirlpool top-load laundry pair, now $886. Not a rewards member? Sign up for free today. But hurry, these July 4th doorbuster deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/7 while supplies last. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.